Windy City Queer Cast.
Gays and lesbians are all the rage.
We're here and we're queer.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
We're talking mega gay.
Ooh, I like that.
I'm Peter Maverick.
I'm Amy Matheny. This Queer Cast is brought to you in part by
Bud Light. Always worth it. American Airlines, offering the GLBT community exciting vacation packages online at aa.com/rainbow.
And BroadwayInChicago.com and The Color Purple. For the hottest tickets in town, visit BroadwayInChicago.com.
And you're listening to the Windy City Queercast. This is show 105. I'm Peter Maverick.
I'm Amy Matheny.
Hey.
Hi, baby.
How's it going?
It's going good.
Well, you know who it's not going good for?
Who?
We have to take... Now, I got to get a little serious here because...
Uh-oh. God, we're already going there.
We're already going there.
Here we go.
I've been paying attention to so much going on in Russia because Russia is an emerging market as it is right now financially. They've got these crazy things going on with their money. They've got these crazy industrialists just making money hand over fist, a new stock market, all kinds of crazy things happening in that marketplace. But as the money comes into the country and as people start to raise their consciousness about more social issues and more social equality, the gays are having a hell of a fucking time over there.
Really?
I don't know anything
about Russian gays.
Well, when they tried to have...
Do we have any on our listening to our Queercast?
If we do, please email us.
We have people listening in Germany and Australia and England, but I don't know about Russia.
Spasiba, please call us or send us...
Was that Russian?
That was please. Or thank you. I think it's please and thank you. They tried to have... There was actually a bloody, bloody thing during their last protest. They're at the stage in their sort of coming out of the closet area as a public.
Right.
Where the police are beating the gay people.
Wow.
They're beating them and making them bloody when they try and demonstrate and do stuff like that. So now they were trying to hold another gay pride parade in Moscow later on this month.
Uh-huh.
And sort of the applications were filed at the Kremlin, city hall, blah, blah, blah. And so as they were being filed, this conservative group started to file its own papers for a counter demonstration to be held the night before the gay march.
Oh my God.
So they're kind of trying
to... Wow, they're on an uphill battle.
It's really intense. The application said there'll be about 5,000 people who want to participate. But under Russian law, the only person who can say it's okay for activities to happen around the Kremlin, which is obviously where they would have their protest, because they're not having a parade yet, right? They're still having a protest. Russian law dictates that the president must authorize everything that happens around the Kremlin. So it's pretty intense.
Is that Putin? Who's our
sure.
president? I don't know.
I actually don't know who's... I think that sounds right now. That sounds good.
Right?
Yeah. Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
Putin. So...
He's kind of come in there and like made... Well, you know, because he was kind of in bed with Bush too, right? Because they were... Yeah. They're old cronies and...
Yep.
And yeah, I don't know.
Well, remember, we're talking about...
There's
a society
of
Orthodox religious people in Moscow. And of course, I always think the further you swing to the left, the further you swing to the right, the further you swing to the right, the further you swing to the left. So the very, very, very strict religious people are going to be the ones who are going to fight against the very, 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 very liberal people.
Well, it's just interesting, you know, because you think like we talk about, you know, the whole Reagan years and what happened. God, it's so weird that it feels like we are back in the Reagan years in some aspects.
Sure does.
And the whole, you know, post-Perestroika momentum that I think, you know, the Clinton administration was really... I mean, what I do know is there was so much devastation, in Russia and financial ruin. And so obviously money, power, Putin, you know.
Well, it's all coming in. And you know, the mayor, Mayor Lushkov right now is the ones... there were some suits against him, some libel suits over claims he made that gay rights marches were satanic.
Oh, good God.
And actually his quote, this is his quote. He said that gay rights marches were, quote, satanic. The speech was broadcast on Moscow television. And then he went on to totally blast gay unions. He said, quote, some European nations bless single-sex marriages and introduce sexual guides in schools, but such things are a deadly moral poison for children. So he's definitely doing a smear campaign thing.
Sounds like a lot of the people at the Republican
probably
debate the other night.
Absolutely. So I'm keeping my eyes to Moscow because I remember looking at those pictures of people. You know, I don't like to watch the news when it's very violent.
Yeah.
But when it's a gay headline, I read it every single time. And seeing guys with blood on their face and bloody people laying in the streets.
Oh.
It's just,
and 5,000 is not a big strong. When you think about how many people are in even like the Chicago Gay Pride Parade, you know, who line the street and are in it, you know, 5,000, that's just not a big, mighty.
That's a brave 5,000.
That's a brave 5,000. I know we talk about, you know, that movie like the 300 or whatever, but 5,000 is not that many for a nation of trying to fight for all of the other GLBT people who are living in that country. That's right. That's really, really, really huge.
The blessing is that people can travel to other countries to celebrate who they are,
yeah.
To have stuff, but still there's a lot of work that still needs to be done in that area of the world. And my heart goes out to them, and yeah. I'll be thinking about them, and I'll be telling all you out there as much as I can learn about them as time goes on, because I think this is really going to be, you know, we've seen how we're doing it in the States.
Right.
We've seen how Europe is doing it. We've seen a huge success story, which I consider South Africa to be just a gigantic success story.
Huge. And, for last year, that was the big, to me, it was one of the biggest stories.
The big thing. And to crack Russia, you know, it means that China's not far behind. I think we can really do it, but I think, you know, it's really starting to spread to the East, truly.
Yeah.
It really is making its way there. I mean, you can just look at it and see how it's migrating that direction. So, I'm just excited. I'm excited that people can be people everywhere in the world. And it's just important, because I would love to go travel in Russia and go to some great gay bars and then just go see the city and do it. But I feel like if I were to go to an Orthodox country like that, I'd have to keep a lot of myself under wraps.
Oh, I'm sure.
And I don't want to have to travel
it's
in a world
beautiful,
that has
beautiful, beautiful, beautiful
oh,
country.
I can only, I mean, even Turkey, even the Middle East, I would love to be able to travel in there freely and openly. And I don't think I could right now. The war notwithstanding and all the badness going on there. But so it's interesting. But on our home front, in your home state, the ACLU actually had
Tennessee?
In Tennessee.
Tennessee.
In Jonesboro. So how do you say that?
Jonesboro.
How do you say that? Jonesboro or Jonesboro?
Jonesboro.
In Jonesboro, Tennessee, a high school principal suspended a student for participating in a silent demonstration to raise awareness about anti-gay violence. And the ACLU demanded that, I don't mean to laugh, but it's Davy Crockett High School, apologize to the student and promise not to punish students who take part in such actions in the future. So there's just, it was a senior in high school. His name was Curtis Wallace, and he wanted to do something positive about harassment that he's had to deal with and everything. So he did this.
Is he openly gay student?
Oh, yes.
Oh, wow. That's a brave one. Talk about Russia's 5,000. Right. That's a brave one in Jonesboro.
So he's graduating, and he said that he wanted things to be better for future gay students than they were for me. And it's pretty ironic that his principal decided to silence me for taking part in a protest in which he was to be silent all day.
Well, you know, it's, I mean, talk about it moving. I mean, I don't know if it's moving in our state, in our United States. It's, you know, it's trying to move south. It really is, I think. And, you know, I went to school in Memphis, and I went to school, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s. And, what's interesting is that, you know, they're just, I mean, good God, there were no GSAs. There were no, I didn't even know any other gay kids.
They didn't
have
the
internet. You didn't have the internet. And, you know, it's so fascinating to me. I don't know what it would be like to be a kid in Tennessee now. And I don't know what it would be like for me. You know, how early would I have come out? Mm. It's just fascinating. I mean, you grew up in Chicago and you grew up in an urban environment.
I came out in 92.
I can't imagine, you know, what my life would look like. I just can't imagine. I mean, post Will and Grace, post Ellen coming out, post Ellen and Rosie being on television every day, post, you know, Ugly Betty, where you had, you know, transsexual characters and
trans America.
I just could not
dedicated to things.
I just could not imagine in my world of renting Desert Hearts and watching Liana, which was an old lesbian movie, or watching The Hunger,
the Torch Song Trilogy, over and over again.
That came out right when
Paris is Burning. That's what brought me out of the closet.
Paris is Burning. I do remember that, but I couldn't even identify with that. I mean, Black Dancers Underground in New York City. Like, I didn't identify with that at all. I thought it was fabulous. I thought they were fabulous, but it was so New York. You know, everybody's gay, and gay just means cool and artistic. It was what I thought, you know, when I would see things like that. So I don't know. Well, Bully for him. Good for him.
Yeah, and, that he actually did it. And it's so interesting that the ACLU stepped up.
Yeah. Well, they usually really do. They come to the small towns and they, because I got some relatives that cannot stand the ACLU. I can tell you they will not mince words about it. So they think of them as horrible leftist people, which, that's not how I see them. But
it's okay.
Hey, you know, when I was one of those little gay kids in my room in Cleveland, Tennessee, one of the people that I loved, and my boyfriend, who's now gay, at the time we both loved, was Bette Midler. And I had my cassette that I had made, because I had albums of Bette Midler, my brother and I had albums, and I had a cassette of her live show, Mud Will Be Flung Tonight, which is one of the most fun. If you, I really need to get that on something besides my cassette, because I don't have a cassette player anymore. But I think it's one of my car. But Bette Midler is replacing Celine Dion, the greatest singer in the world, at Caesars.
Really?
Celine's contract is over. It is official now that she will be the headliner in Vegas. It was announced this past week. And so, you know, there was a lot of speculation. It's a 4,100 seat Coliseum. I have been there. I saw Celine in the second row, and it's just an amazing theatrical space. Yeah. And having seen Bette Midler only once in my life live, I saw her at the United Center on the Kiss My Brass tour. And she walks, you know, that quick little walk, and she's talking, and she's, you know, you never forget it, you know? And she's like walking back and forth, or she's singing. And that United Center is the whole width of like an entire basketball court. Yeah. I mean, a big coliseum.
Huge.
And this stage is really wide too. And at Caesars, the way it's set up, it's just fantastic. It's the most amazing theater, the most amazing sound. And, She's going to be thin, girl. Her ass is going to be hard. You're going to be bounce quarters off that ass, because she walks so much, you know, back and forth to the opposite ends. But
she'll have big gay dancers, and she'll have, God, I can't wait.
She is such a better concert. I mean, she is an amazing concert. She, you know, I know everybody loves the whole Cher and the Farewell Tour that never ended, but this Bette Midler is just, there is just nobody live like her. I am sorry. She is totally a great person.
She's
for
Judy
Celine
Garland
to pass that baton to.
The drugs and the pills and the booze.
Yeah, and just, wow, just awesome. So I am going to be getting my tickets. I encourage you to get yours.
We need to get her
well
on the show. That's what we need to do.
Well, I'd love that. I've never interviewed Bette Midler.
We need to just get her on the show. Studio 60 is canceled. Yay!
Yay! My girlfriend will be sad. But
I really don't like that. I've tried to like that show. I just haven't. And sadly, the Gilmore Girls.
Last episode was this week.
Yeah, I did not set my DVR.
My TiVo, but I have not watched it yet. I really just don't want it to be over, but it was on Tuesday night.
I'll
watch it this weekend.
Luke takes his shirt off in the last show. I just want that.
Oh,
I just want to see Luke's first.
At my house, we actually have a moratorium. We can't even talk about it. We haven't watched it yet. And actually, this morning I said something to Kelly about it, and she was like, I can't even talk about it. I just can't even talk about the Gills.
Oh.
She's so sad. She cannot understand it.
But I'm happy because it will free Lauren Graham up to do some most...
She is so fabulous.
I don't think Alexis Bledel is going to do anything.
Well, it'll just depend, you know?
She's been Rory in every single thing that she's done outside of the Gilmore Girls.
Well, I don't
she's
know.
She's like
but,
Jamie Foxx in Dreamgirls. She's got one note.
But you know what? Her one note is really charming and has a lot of notes within it. And I think that in the same way, I think she really could evolve into a very... she's not going to be like... the little girl from Once and Again. Why am I drawing a blank? Who's, you know, kind of going to... The young... I think she'll be this young... I think Alexis is a really great actress. And she's still plays very young, and she's not young. And she still reads very young. And I think that, I think she will. And Lauren Graham definitely will.
Oh my God. I can't wait.
This.
I can't wait for
we'll
her to
definitely
just open
have a career.
Up and soar and fly.
She's so amazing. And I would lavish her with tons of Golden Globes and Emmys if I could. Cause I have just been delighted.
You'd lavish her with a sponge bath. Don't lie.
No, I'm not that kind with her. I really just admire.
Really?
Yeah, I know. I'm not sexually attracted to her.
She is the hottest woman on television today.
Okay, well, that's good. I just really admire her. I think she is amazing at her craft, and she just never ceases to give me a delivery that is fresh and crisp and shocking and right on.
Yeah.
She's the
character of Lorelai is somebody I would love to hang out with.
Oh, God.
Like beer and pizza with her would be so much fun. You'd have to watch Tootsie with her.
I would have to watch Tootsie with her because that would be fabulous.
she would totally love it. So one final thing, a little bit of local yokel. Any of you who don't live in Chicago probably heard about the stupid law that was put on the books that we banned foie gras in Chicago restaurants.
Yeah, what the hell? We're so dumb.
It's no, well, you know, it's the aldermen trying to show their virility and their prowess. And Mayor Daley was like, you know what? Fuck this. So he's set to repeal it, and he's probably going to repeal it and be very successful for it.
I mean,
so,
I don't eat foie gras, but...
Oh, I do. It's delightful.
I don't eat foie gras, but... Have you ever had it? I don't eat venison, really, either. Oh, yes. We had it in our restaurant. I, you know, people would come up to me and go, I can't believe you have foie gras in your restaurant and stuff like
that.
Are you
serious?
People feel very strong about it who are anti... having it
with leather shoes, eating meat.
I know, it's just because it's entirely farmed for this one reason, but
honey, that's what they raised the cows for.
Well, it's not entirely true. We milk the cows. We have some beef cattle. Yes, we have dairy cattle.
Beef cattle and milk cattle are very two different things. You don't eat the milk cows and you don't drink milk from the beef cows.
Well, this is true. This is what I'm saying. But anyhow, I don't know.
Visit a slaughterhouse and foie gras is nice.
Yeah.
Foie gras is kind treatment,
I'm sure. You know, well, it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, well, but I love veal too. So
I know,
you know, but on the show today,
we have a show that I'm really excited about. I kind of am sitting down in a little local sweetery, Sweet Occasions up in Andersonville.
Oh my God. That's why I've got this little tie around my center.
Yeah. I love their coconut everything. So coconut and anything in a cupcake form. I sat down with a woman that I met many years ago, and I won't tell you much because I'll share the story while I'm sitting with her, but her name is Jacqueline Taylor. I know her as Jackie Taylor. She's come out with a new book, Waiting for the Call. And it tells basically her story of growing up as a Southern child of a Baptist minister, and growing up now to be a woman in Chicago who has been lived an openly lesbian life, adopted two Guatemalan girls many years ago. When I met her, she was one of the first women or gay couple or anything that I knew who had adopted children, and was one of the first successful, I mean, they were, that her and her partner were on NPR and all kinds of things for being one of the first successful second parent adoptions here in the state of Illinois.
Oh, wow.
And it's really just a whole story of, you know, how she, married aspects of her life that seem contradictory. And I can relate to that so much. And, so she is on the show. Her book, Waiting for the Call, has just been published, and I have been waiting for this book. And I've known that she was going to write it since almost very early on when I met her. So, I'm thrilled to have Jackie on. I think it's a really engaging conversation that I'm letting you all sit in with us on.
Hey.
And we've got news and much, much more. It's a great week. And hey, folks, we have some great shows coming up for you in the next few weeks. So, and as we head into our big
Pride
and Windy City Gay Idol getting closer and closer to the finals, we will have much more to talk about. But sit back, relax, and we're going to be with you for a little bit longer. Jacqueline Taylor on our show today.
You love the book. You love the movie. Now the story you love comes to Chicago at the Cadillac Palace Theater. Oprah Winfrey presents The Color Purple. Unforgettable characters, a triumphant story, and music that's simply amazing. It's truly the must-see musical event of the year. Now playing at the Cadillac Palace Theater. Tickets still available. Call Ticketmaster. Log on to colorpurple.com. Oprah Winfrey presents The Color Purple, sponsored by Ariel Mutual Funds.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Edible Underwear Maker.
Mr. Edible Underwear Maker!
Your true genius combined two of man's favorite things, panties and food.
I can taste it now!
They're a snack, they're underwear. They're a snack and underwear. Brilliant.
Two treats in one.
Gorgeous grape, rock my world raspberry, bodacious banana.
26 flavors.
And nothing says, I want you, like a man with a mouthful of underpants.
I want you, baby.
So crack open an ice cold Bud Light, Mr. Edible Underwear Maker. Because thanks to you, when it comes to panties, extra large means extra yummy.
Yummy.
Missouri.
It's been 20 years in the making. June 8th, 9th, and 10th. Be a part of history as tens of thousands will join a celebration of equal rights and diversity that will take place on Milwaukee's lakefront. Fest. Pride Fest 2007. Pride Fest. At Henry Mayer Festival Park. With explosive performances by Chaka Khan. Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. Comedian Kathy Griffin.
I had a run-in with Whitney Houston. Are you in? Or as I call her, Cracky. Allegedly! Allegedly!
Cascada. Every time we touch, I get this feeling. Nikki French. Over 60 exciting acts on multiple stages of entertainment with the highly anticipated Pride Idol. Get tickets, more information, and the complete lineup now at PrideFest.com. Pride Fest 2007, June 8th, 9th, and 10th at the Summerfest grounds on Milwaukee's lakefront. Proudly sponsored by Windy City Media, Potawatomi Bingo Casino, and Miller Lite, the official beer of Pride Fest. Pride Fest 2007, June 8th, 9th, and 10th. Visit PrideFest.com now. Pride Fest. Pride Fest.
Guess what, folks? She's coming to Chicago. Janeane Garofalo for one night only. Tuesday, June 19th at the Lakeshore Theater, 3125 North Broadway at the corner of Broadway and Belmont. Don't miss the hilarious, dry, and sardonic star of stand-up and movies, Janeane Garofalo. It's an all-ages show. Doors open at 6 p.m. And for tickets, you can visit LiveNation.com, Ticketmaster, or visit the Lakeshore Theater box office. Janeane Garofalo, Tuesday, June 19th. Get your tickets now.
Culture Club.
Culture Club.
Culture Club.
Theater.
Music.
Dance.
Art.
Performance.
Provocative.
Hilarious.
Exciting.
Weird.
Innovative.
Campy.
Edgy.
Original.
Get some culture in your life.
Join the club.
For the week of May 14th, 2007, you are in Chicago's Culture Club.
Now at Writers Theater, the puppet master of Lodz, Chicago Sun-Times, says the artistry is all highly imaginative and strangely beautiful. A mesmerizing portrayal. After escaping from Auschwitz, a once revered puppet master has barricaded himself in an attic. In an attempt to bring back his lost family, he prepares for his greatest puppet show ever. For more about the puppet master of Lodz, log on to writerstheater.org or call 847-242-6000.
Pulp is back and better than ever. About Face Theater's deliciously campy homage to the sultry world of lesbian pulp fiction is playing now through May 27th only. Join playwright Patricia Kane and the original cast for the return of the hit comedy The Tribune called funny, smart, and eminently entertaining, and the LA Times hailed as a comic bullseye. Get your tickets for Pulp now at aboutfacetheater.com. Many shows are already sold out.
And for more Culture Club, visit WindyCityTimes.com. And this is your Windy City Queercast News. Berkeley, California is considering paying for sexual reassignment operations under its employee health care plan. The proposal materialized after transsexual city worker Lynn Reardon said that her 2003 surgery cost $11,000, which she paid for out of pocket.
New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, who recently became the first person in his political position to propose same-sex marriage legislation, has offered more details about his plan. In a two-page memo, Spitzer said, same-sex couples who wish to marry are not simply looking to obtain additional rights, they are seeking out substantial responsibilities as well, to undertake significant and binding obligations to one another and to lives of shared intimacy and mutual financial and emotional support.
Yay, anti-Giuliani, we like that.
Yes.
Four members of the University of Vermont fraternity Phi Delta Gamma might sue the school after being accused of violating the state's anti-hazing statute by forcing pledges to dress in gay cowboy attire and teasing them with anti-gay slurs. Last year, a judge rejected the case based on insufficient evidence and an appeal was dropped.
I call them Gamma felt a thigh. That's what I call them.
Terrible.
In Pennsylvania, a state court ruled that a now dead man who donated sperm for a lesbian couple's children must pay child support.
What?
The panel held that Carl L. Frampton Jr. had become involved with the family as a step parent. Frampton died while the case was being considered.
Oh no. Planet Out Incorporated has taken a dive in the stock market. Stock has dipped to its lowest ever, decreasing to $1.45 per share, far below the company's previous low of $2.38.
The Log Cabin Republicans recently held their annual national convention in Denver. Many attendees favored Rudolph Giuliani with his record on everything from social issues to national defense. Several people also felt that the eventual Republican presidential candidate should not focus on controversial social issues.
What, are they going to focus on money? No, not going to happen. The presence of smoking in a movie may affect a film's rating. The Motion Picture Association of America, under increasing pressure to change its ratings criteria by who I don't know, announced that it would look at the amount and type of smoking in a film to help determine its rating.
Gosh, thank you for not smoking would be like a triple X.
Oh my goodness.
And Bobby Brown has decided to sue ex-wife Whitney Houston to alter the terms of the custody agreement involving their daughter, Bobby Christina. Brown, who wants spousal and child support, said that he has been homeless at times since splitting from Houston.
How did Bobby Brown not get no money? If you're expecting Britney Spears' upcoming CD to dish on her recent meltdown, forget it. Producer Nate Donja Hills says that the album is all about living it up and having fun. Something I think she's been doing, saying, quote, she didn't let none of her personal life into what she was doing. The first single is expected in September.
And in its first week, the Dreamgirls DVD topped the sales charts with 32 million spent on copies. The musical starring Oscar winner Jennifer Hudson, Beyonce Knowles, and Eddie Murphy displaced A Night at the Museum.
And that's your Windy City Queercast News.
Hello, pineapples. I'm Miss Fousey, and you're listening to Windy City Queercast. I love them.
You can cry a million tears. So I'm really thrilled to be sitting down with Jackie Taylor, Jacqueline Taylor. It's when you become an author, your full name has
That's
to come
right.
out there. Her title is, she's the Dean of the College of Communication and Professor of Communication at DePaul University here in Chicago, a very prestigious university. But I know Jackie because I remember when I started going to the church that I became a member of, Broadway United Methodist, which many of you know if you listen to the show. I've talked a lot about my faith. I've talked a lot about my personal journey, being Christian, being lesbian, being Southern, all these are themes that have come up. And I remember I was in our church lobby, for people who don't go to church, that would be what I'd call it, the vestibule area or the lobby area. And I heard this one with an accent, and it was Jackie Taylor. And at some point, I don't remember, this is how I remember it, so this part gets to be my story, Jackie, is that somehow I heard your accent, and you and I started talking, and then I remember the first conversation just talking about where we were from, being lesbian, being in Chicago. You were in a much different place in your life. You know, your family was established. But I just felt such a kinship that, you know, I'm not the only one, even here in Chicago, who had this particular upbringing and is still finding a reason to tell my story. And a more passionate reason to tell my story as I've gone along. And at that time, Jackie told me that she was working on a book. And the book has come out, and I am thrilled when I first got the press release that I hadn't seen Jackie in a while. When I got the press release that Waiting for the Call, which is her book, From Preacher's Daughter to Lesbian Mom, was coming out, I immediately called publisher, said, get me an interview and get me a copy of the book. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you,
this
Amy.
It's a long journey, I know. And it's a life, you know. It's a life, and then you have to have some... I've just had this mouthpiece of the radio that whenever I want to talk about it, I can talk about it, you know.
But
you
fun.
Really, it is fun, but you got to sit down and actually probably sound more intelligent talking about it. But I want to just let people know, I mean, I really just... in the past, you know, we just celebrated our 100th show in the past month, and
congratulations to you.
Thank you.
What an accomplishment.
It's really fantastic. We have people listening from around the world, and so I feel like they get a little bit of Chicago, a little bit of my Southern heritage, but we've had amazing people on who've talked about faith and spirituality and the GLBT community. And so I want to just share kind of a little bit about what your story is. Where were you born?
Well, I was born in Kentucky. I was actually born in Owensboro, Kentucky, but most of the story from my childhood is set in Somerset, Kentucky, a little town in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains.
Right.
That we moved to when I was 7 years old because my father had been called to pastor a very large church in this very small town. First Baptist Church is just so perfect.
That yes.
It was on Main Street. I mean, literally.
It's like Bible Belt.
I mean, I'm not making any of this up. The name of the church is First Baptist.
Yep.
And the street is Main Street. We
right.
lived in the parsonage, literally and figuratively, in the shadow of the church.
And so, I mean, you're obviously an ambitious woman. So you get very early in the book that you were an ambitious child. I can really relate to that. And you're also
had this way of viewing your father, which I can really relate to. My father was not a minister, as people know who've listened to me over the years, but he has a preacher way about him and was definitely a lay minister of churches. And I saw something kind of magical and powerful in that. And that is lends itself at the beginning to the title of your book, Waiting for the Call. What is the call? And what did it mean to you as a young child to be waiting for the call?
Well, certainly all Southern Baptist children know the answer to this question, and probably lots of other children raised in an evangelical tradition know that the call is...
I have to inform the people in Germany and Australia
who
are like, what the hell is this?
Of course.
The call.
So we were raised to believe that God had a specific plan for our lives and that God was going to call us. Pretty much with instructions. Now, we weren't expecting to, you know, get this over the phone. This,
right.
Exactly. But that really, we were taught that not just people who are called a special ministry, which would be like to pastor a church or to be a missionary or something like that, or to be a minister of music or a minister of education, not just clergy people and missionaries, but every one of us, God had a specific plan for us. And it was going to be a call to some kind of service, whether it might be anything, but it would be a life of service. And we would also be called to a marriage partner. I mean, our specific husband was out there somewhere for us, and God would, and my sister and I, we will swear on a stack of Bibles that we went to college thinking we needed no plans, because God had it all mapped out, and sooner or later
we would all unfold.
We would understand what our call was.
Well, now, I don't know. I mean, you can look at this in one way and kind of blow it out of proportion and go, that's absurd. You're going to be told exactly what job you're going to be doing. But I would say, if people read your book, that you feel like your life, you have been called. And it actually, what you believed as a child may actually be the reality of your life. Just possibly not in the way we expected our life to look.
Right. Well,
and I that's think, the charm of your book.
I think what people who read the book will discover is that rather than kind of getting mad and rejecting all of the things that I was taught, that in a lot of ways I tweaked them or I came
right.
to understand them
That's
differently.
That's exactly what I did. I get that very much.
And so I've joked with people that there was unquestionably some irony for me in spending several years actually, because I did this on the side while I was working full time and raising kids.
Right.
Writing a book, which I knew from the beginning, I didn't know what the subtitle might be, and the subtitle could have been almost anything, but I knew the title was Waiting for the Call. To write a book called Waiting for the Call, as if you're still waiting, while in the grip of a conviction that you are supposed to be writing this book, that you have been given this
right.
book. And, you know, the truth, since we're friends, I will tell you.
Well, you're telling a lot of people. You're not just telling me.
The whole time I wrote this book, I was praying that the book that I wrote would be the book that I was supposed to write, and that it would go out into the world in the way that it was supposed to go out in the world. So there's a little contradiction in calling the book Waiting for the Call and having those kind of feelings. But I don't think, whether you're raised in a religious tradition or not, I don't think it's unusual for writers to sometimes have a feeling that a book is not being written by them but coming through them.
Well, and people, I think, feel that in any mode, possibly,
any
of expression or
right.
anything creative that they do. So tell us, just give me a snapshot of your parents.
Well,
in the environment in which you were brought up. I mean, how strict are we talking?
Well, in terms of how strict we're talking no dancing, no drinking, no playing cards. In the house, we had some deck of cards called Rook, which had
yes,
a crow on it.
Yes, I remember Rook cards.
And
there's
numbers.
The devil, right?
There's no hearts and spades and all that.
had Rook. I've not thought of that in years.
We couldn't do what we call go to the show on Sunday, which meant go to the movies, because
right.
I don't know exactly. I never quite got why that
was
wrong.
You didn't ask very much, which is good somehow.
I ask a lot of things, but I didn't think they asked, you know, why can't we go to movies on Sunday? Anyway, we didn't have time. We were so busy going to church on Sunday. So,
but your father was really a leader in the community, and your mother was really supportive of that.
Yeah, but I think, you know, when I say, okay, we had all these rules that Baptists, that was typical, that
right.
certainly then, my parents were highly educated. people. Both had not only college degrees, but master's degrees from the seminary. My father had a master's of divinity, and my mother's, I think, had a master's in religious education. And so they were highly educated people and really cultured, cultivated people. So I think sometimes when people hear a Baptist preacher, they have this one very flat stereotype in their mind that really doesn't conform to... But it was a... So what kind of people were my parents? Well, I claim to have had some of the best parents in the world. And I think people who read the book will just have to agree that they were remarkable, were, in my case, father's case, are remarkable people.
So let's jump ahead a little bit. Because the book, though it, you know, sets off where your roots are from and kind of the core aspect of your identity, which is something I just really relate to. You know, you forged ahead, life goes on. I don't tell the whole story, but obviously the book, Waiting for the Call, Preacher's Daughter to Lesbian Mom, deals a lot with your current life, with your partner, Carol, and with your two beautiful daughters, Lucy and Gracie, who I've been able to see grow up. And I have to say, I was reading, like, the foreword of your book the first night, and I sat there, and I'm, like, in bed with my partner, and I'm, like, sobbing your story about Lucy joining the church. And it's just really, really beautiful. And I think the big struggle that I've always talked about is this aspect of grappling with one's sexuality and one's spirituality that I think you talk about so beautifully, not only for yourself, but also with your family and for your children. So let's talk a little bit about that. After coming out, talk about that journey between realizing that you were lesbian a little later, and then also knowing what you felt spiritually, and how did you, I don't like the word reconcile, I know that's a word we've adopted, but how did you just kind of hold all of that within yourself?
I didn't always. I think that when I first went to college, I really kind of felt like I'd gone to church enough to last a lifetime. I really didn't have to go anymore. And that then I would visit churches and then feel kind of a misfit. I was very troubled by the Baptist position on women, and then as time went by, on sexuality in general and sexual orientation. And so I felt like I couldn't make it fit the kind of, and Southern Baptist, you know, there's so many wonderful things about that tradition that I come out of, but there's also a very, there's a tradition about race relations that's not.
Right. I mean, most of the churches of the South, I mean, have their own history with that.
So I thought, okay, I can live without church, and for a lot of years I did, and I would feel kind of homesickness, especially, I have to admit, for hymns, but also for singing.
Right.
For singing hymns with people.
I can relate to that. Well, so what became the conversation with you and Carol, once you met Carol, of like trying to dip back into finding a church?
It was really having the children that brought us back to church. And it was very, I would say, probably something we both felt could add to our family life, but was probably of greater concern to me because it had so been a part of my childhood that I couldn't picture myself raising children without having some sort of faith community that I felt like it even if you end up walking away from it, it gets you a place to start thinking about what is beyond us and between us, and how to create community, and what might be a place to anchor some of your values. And that, for me, it didn't even seem so important which tradition you brought your children up in, as that there be one, that some sort of faith tradition. And it seemed obvious to me that the one I could let best lay claim to is the one that the Protestant tradition that I was connected to. So while Baptist was not an option, Protestant seemed still a viable option. And it seemed to me and Carol that, and she had actually been raised Methodist, although they weren't nearly as involved in the church as our family was.
Right.
So it just seemed like there ought to be a church out there somewhere, certainly in a city like Chicago. So we had these criteria, and they included it had to be not just tolerant of a family like ours, but prepared to celebrate it. We were not going to take our kids to a church where they would learn that there was something fundamentally wrong with their family. And then second of all, we wanted there to be good music, because music was a really important part of our what we both liked about church growing up. And then there had to be preaching that I could connect to in some way, that seemed intelligent, that seemed, and there need to be diversity and a commitment to social justice. Now, when you put all those things together, you don't have a long list of churches to choose from.
Well, luckily, Broadway United Methodist kind of definitely is a star in
really special place.
Let me go back a little bit and talk about Gracie and Lucy, because you talk about at the time that you were adopting your two daughters. That was a different time, and there's been a lot. You all were very pioneering. I remember when I met you, you were one of the first couples that I'd ever met that were adopting children out of the country. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know that you got a lot of attention, and you were called on to talk quite a bit about single parent adoption, right, and what that meant for you.
Yeah. We didn't ever think of ourselves as pioneers, and oddly enough, it was only last year, as I was going through the final copy edits on this book, maybe last fall, and I'm reading through this book again, and one of the things that the editor had asked me to do is, as I went back through the book, to try to connect what was happening to us personally to what was going on in the world.
Yeah. And what year was this? What year were you adopting?
We began talking about the first adoption in 88 and did it in 1989. And honestly, there were lesbian couples who had done this already on both coasts, and I think even in some places in the Midwest, including, Madison, Wisconsin, we later met some women who had adopted a year or two before us. But we didn't know one single lesbian couple in Chicago that had even had children in the context of their couple relationship after forming that couple, as opposed to, of course, we knew lesbians who had children from a heterosexual marriage that they brought with them into the relationship. In fact, I remember that we got the name of a couple in Boston who had done an international adoption, and called up this lesbian couple that we didn't even know, just to talk to them about their experience, because there were no role models. There was nobody to even ask how to do this. So when I look back on it, we were pioneers.
Was this based out of an intrinsic passion to have kids, or what do you think was the spark that really went, this is possible, we can call some stranger in another city who's done it?
I had always wanted to have children, and I had been married and divorced, and while I was married had tried to have children unsuccessfully. I'd had some failed pregnancies, which I talked a little bit about in the book. But when I came out and got with Carol, I figured it was just not going to happen. I figured Carol was not interested in having children. But she said to me several times, well, if you really want to have children, I don't want to get between you and your life's dearest wish, so we'll figure out a way to do it. And I said, no, because you say that, but you would hate me for it.
Right.
It'd be too much work. You'd make that offer, then we'd have the child, and I don't want to lose you after I've finally found you. So this will just be one of the things in my life I wanted to do that I didn't get to do. And I thought about it as a path I couldn't go down. There'd be some loss attached to that, but there would be some gains. There's some advantages to not having children, as well as some. So it's a mixture, And then Carol's sister had had a child. So Carol had a niece that she was crazy about, and we had her over to our house several times, including for sleepovers. And we were involved in her life, but we could see, in a tangential way. And at a certain point, Carol, I think probably around the time she turned 40, just thought, wait a minute. And we had been together 5 years. we were starting to be really comfortable in our careers. We were starting to have, you know, all our needs were met. And we kind of looked at each other and thought, okay, now what? Are we just going to sit around and figure out what trip to take next or what,
right,
how we should furnish our house?
Right.
Or what are we going to do with all these years stretching out in front of us? And Carol said, I feel like I really want to be a mother. Mm-hmm. How would you feel about that? And, of course, my heart just leapt. I thought, I'd be thrilled, but, you know, get back to me when you really make your mind up.
Yeah, right.
I didn't want to think about it if it wasn't really going to happen.
Don't dangle the carrot.
Yeah,
if you're not.
Don't tease me, honey. Yeah,
if it's not real. So they have obviously informed, as you said earlier, your search then to find a church home, a church family, a way in which to raise Gracie and Lucy.
Yeah.
But you have this part in the book where you're talking, and it's something that we haven't talked a lot. We haven't talked really, I don't think at all, on the Queercast about this, but definitely I talked on Lesbi Gay Radio about this, just about, you know, being gay parents and being children of gay and lesbian couples. And, you know, there are many challenges that I'm sure we can, even if we're not in that scenario, that we can, you know, just imagine.
Yeah.
And you talk about, you know, your the chief concern to, like, protect your children, and with, you know, children who have gay or lesbian parents, that there's a whole wider spectrum of how do you protect them. And what have been the challenges for that, and where has probably your faith and the choices you've made to have a church home or a fellowship, have those helped and informed you as a parent feel, you know, like you've created some protection, and also how has that helped Gracie and Lucy? It's a really loaded question.
There's a lot of pieces to that question, but I would say that
just basically, what were the biggest challenges that you felt? And are you really in control of any of them?
That's too many questions, but let me just try to pick on two or three of those and see if I can. I think Chicago is a really, in many respects, hospitable environment in which to try to carve out space to be a lesbian family, but it's still tough. And some of the ways in which it's tough seem small, but they really, it's kind of an accretion of, it's a repetition of the same issue over and over, that you have to, and especially in those early years even more, but still, you feel like you have to go into a space and say, hi, we're here, we're a family. You see the two of us, we're the two moms. These are our children, we are a family. These
right.
two girls are sisters to each other, they are our daughters, we are their moms, they have two moms.
Right.
And then you get, you know, this, wherever you go, for school, for the doctor, for music lessons, wherever you go, you're given a form, and it says father, mother, and you keep crossing out father and writing in parent.
Uh-huh.
You know, just little things like that, and you keep pointing to one another and say, see us, we're a family, and you just feel like everywhere you go, you have to...
We have to come out as a family, every experience.
Everywhere you go, and so that's one of the challenges, and then the kids, you know, I talk a little bit about in the book of... There's one chapter called Which One Is Your Mom that's mm-hmm. really devoted to just, it's almost that one chapter more than I think some others is almost like a sequence of anecdotes about our interface with the world and the,
right.
some of the kinds of things that happened as the girls moved out into school and other settings. So I think we had a whole series of strategies for trying to make space for ourselves, and one was that constant coming out and announcing ourselves, even as we entered, if we entered a new preschool, if we entered a new school, if we entered a doctor's office, from the word go, saying, here we are, we're together, we're a family, these are the two moms, etc. But the church was a piece of that kind of array of choices we made about how to function in the world that would make space. And I think that for the girls, one of the strengths that Broadway offered was that it gave them the notion that God is absolutely on the side of social justice and that God loves diversity and that whatever they do going forward, whether they stay connected to this church, another faith, or no faith, they'll still have that kind of foundation. And it also gave them a real gay-friendly environment that was not just a gay environment. You know, as the girls have gotten older, I've thought about how many identities our girls have to balance and hold at once. So,
because you didn't adopt them in America.
They're Peruvian. So they are indigenous Peruvians who are being raised absolutely from infants as Americans. So there's by white women. So
right.
there's a way in
one
which,
of them with an accent.
Right. Well, my view, we all have accents.
We all have accents, don't we?
So there's that piece that they have to negotiate a kind of interracial family and their own, in a way, interracial identity, because although they're Hispanic, they're also raised in a family that the moms are white.
Right.
And then their moms are lesbian, but they are not. So they have a comfort level, but also a need to negotiate both, to a greater extent than Carol and I do, the heterosexual world and the gay and lesbian world. And so our church was a very gay, as you know, is a gay-friendly environment, but it's not a gay environment. So they saw lots of gay men and gay couples and gay men that were marrying each other and lesbian couples and lesbians that were marrying each other or, you know, okay, holy union ceremonies,
right.
whatever. But also lots of heterosexuals.
Yeah. And young and old.
Young and old. And all those people love their family and love them. And I think that probably maybe more than they'll even recognize until they're much older, that was one in a kind of arsenal of things we had that helped make a safe space for us.
Well, and also, they have the understanding of the world of their... even in the beginning of the book, about they have the understanding of kind of your background in a family of faith and
right.
how that family of faith
right.
is different than this family of faith. And Lucy's comparison of, like, what her grandfather, giving them Bible books and things like
right.
that, and your... And a more expansive or different family of faith and their perception. And there's kind of the wonderful thing I really got from the book is that how much acceptance you've come to, how you've almost just pedaled right into falling into an acceptance in each aspect of your life. Even we're sitting here talking now about the whole, when you're married and couldn't get pregnant and didn't think it was going to happen with Carol and then it happens, you have just kind of impatiently letting things fall into place as they will to a point of acceptance. That sounds like you've set up a thing for your daughters to kind of have that too, in a beautiful way. Because I think that's like a really bad aspect of not only our community but just the world. You know, that we always want it different than how it is. We're impatient for it until now. We want what we want when we want it, and that doesn't allow for us to truly have moments of grace and acceptance of where we've been and when things are supposed to happen in their own time. But it seems like, that that story especially, I can see that in your children, I don't know how you teach that, but somehow you have.
I think one aspect of that is an aspect that relates to every single child who is adopted. And that is, you as the adoptive parent can make a decision that you are going to make space for that child to love and cherish their biological kin, even if they can never be known, and not be threatened by that, and allow that to be a part of who they are. It's core to them. This child would not be here without those biological parents,
right.
Even if they never spend any time with them. And so they're going to have feelings about that of some sort, and that you should make... I feel really strongly that you make room for them to love that piece of themselves, that love themselves, which means loving who they come from.
Right.
And I think, we also made a decision that we made very consciously when we were planning to adopt. We said to one another, okay, we won't hide. We won't pretend not to be lesbians, and we won't pretend not to be a lesbian family, but we will not ask our children to be our standard bearers. They don't have to be in any gay pride parade for us. They don't have to trot us out. They don't have to be lesbian or gay advocates. And that we decided before we adopted them, and probably before they were even born, that if they were self-conscious about us being lesbians when they were teenagers, we would understand that and it would be okay with us. We wouldn't agree to disappear or to lie about who we were, but
everybody's embarrassed their parents.
Right. I thought, you know, hey,
at 13,
exactly. Parents are so embarrassing at that age. So I think we just made some decisions about. It's part of just being open to all that is,
yeah,
and not trying to control it all.
What do you think? This is a really loaded question, but it's a simple question. What do you think is the biggest struggle for gay people and spirituality? My thesis has been over the past number of years that we have somehow, as a GLBT community, replaced sexuality as our spirituality, and it doesn't work. It's one of the things that I think is a crippling aspect to our community. I don't care what spirituality that is, but you can't kind of throw the baby out with the proverbial bathwater.
But I think, in fairness to the gay and lesbian community, they kicked us out before we walked away. So,
well, the institutions did.
The institutions
but the
did.
Sense of, but the feeling that we deserve to have something that fills our spirits, that's right. Not sex.
Right. Well, I just think that there, you know, part of what made me interested in writing this book is that I thought I am not either a preacher's daughter or a lesbian. I'm both. Always, you know, I didn't go from one to another. It's really that they're both totally connected and part of the journey all along. And I think that the thing that's hard is that a lot of the most virulent homophobia is taught by organized religion. So a lot of gay and lesbian people just say, out of here, not doing that. And with understandably, but I think you're right that then.
But does many the quest of us need to end then?
Many of us absolutely then experience a void in our lives, yeah, that there's something missing.
And it is. It's that thing of we go and fill it with sex. You know, the male community maybe more than the female community fills it with drugs. I mean, it. You know, I think it is this hole. And you know, and like I said, I'm fine if somebody wants to go off and practice some other form of. I mean, if it's yogic for you, if it's Buddhism, if it's whatever, I just feel like we can't reject that spirituality is a core part of every culture on this globe, you know, and for somehow our community, you know, and I would only be able to speak from American community, you know, has somehow rejected. We don't need that, you know, it doesn't. And I do think it is exactly what you said, that it is connected to organized religion,
right.
Probably Judeo-Christian organized religion, yeah, you know, primarily. But well, and it's a beautiful book, and I love how you just wrapped it up. That's why you wrote the book. I mean, these are both aspects of you, and it is really a moving book, and a great story. Great, really, just you know, see somebody's life on a page is wonderful and quite precious and voyeuristic at the same time, but you know, as they all are. It's why I love autobiography and biography. But you can pick up this book. It is out on the University of Michigan Press, and of course go to your gay and lesbian bookstores. But where else can people pick up the book?
It's actually showing up in quite a few bookstores now, and you can order it right off the University of Michigan Press website. So it should be out there readily available.
Excellent.
And if your bookstore doesn't have it,
tell them to
order it.
Yes, it's called Waiting for the Call, From Preacher's Daughter to Lesbian Mom by Jacqueline Taylor. And you've got some wonderful people who have obviously put their quotes to this. Mel White, of course, everybody knows we did a really well-received show early in our podcasting with Reverend White. And it's so such a beautiful book.
Well, thank you so much, Amy.
So thanks for spending some time with us.
Oh, it's been great. Thanks for your interest in the book.
And you're going to be here locally at Women and Children First, so people should visit womenandchildrenfirst.com, and we will have all that linked on our website on the windycitycareercast.com.
And I'm also going to be in the Printers Row Book Fair on June 10th, which is really exciting.
So come out and meet Jackie or... you know, we will link this on our site so you can find out exactly where she'll be traveling and touring in case she's coming near you.
Great.
All right. Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to another Windy City Queercast. This show is brought to you in part by Bud Light. Bud Light, always worth it.
And American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow.
And Broadway in Chicago, for the hottest tickets in town, visit broadwayinchicago.com.
So that's our show. I'm Amy Matheny.
And I'm Peter Maverick. Please comment on our shows on our website and in iTunes.
The next Queercast is only days away, so don't miss it.
Windy City Queercast, queer and now.
Make romance, it might break your heart, but if you think that time will change your ways, don't wait too long. Don't
The best and the brightest, served up daily by the sharpest minds in content delivery, Pod Show and Limelight.